You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Today you'll hear an update from our Brexit unit, led by the IEA's chief economist, Julian Jessop. Coming up, Digital Officer Madeline Grant asked Julian about potential transitional arrangements between the UK and the EU after March 2019. The pair discuss whether or not it's too early to consider such arrangements, what the varying options are if they were to be implemented, and how a transitional arrangement could affect other aspects of the UK's departure, like the divorce bill. If you like what you hear, be sure to check out our website, iea.org.uk, and subscribe to our YouTube channel, username IEA London.
During his Mansion House speech a few months ago, the Chancellor of the Exchequer talked about negotiating transitional arrangements to avoid what he's termed dangerous cliff edges. It's recently been confirmed that the government team will indeed be seeking such a deal. Of course, British businesses do need reassurances and time to organise themselves over the next few years. But with the negotiations teams seemingly at loggerheads, isn't it a little too early to be discussing transitional agreements?
Well, you're right. In principle, talks don't have to be concluded until October next year. And that's allowing EU members another 6 months to ratify the withdrawal agreement in time for the UK's departure in March 2019. But in practice, I think it's very unlikely that the UK and the EU will be able to agree the sort of comprehensive free trade deal covering all aspects of a new relationship by then. And in the meantime, the UK economy is already starting to suffer from the uncertainty. So I think it is right at this early stage to start discussions about some sort of transitional arrangement, particularly the long lags in investment and contingency planning. Basically, businesses need some reassurance that there won't be a cliff edge in 2019. And I think some clarity by the end of this year is going to be essential.
Given, I suppose, that the lack of progress that has been made, at least on that front, it seems to be that so far little consensus has been agreed, at least if you believe the EU negotiating team's analysis. Would it be a possibility to simply delay Brexit, giving a longer window for negotiations?
Well, I don't think it's a completely crazy idea, at least in law. Article 50 of the EU treaty does allow for the two-year deadline to be extended if all parties agree. And in a sense, that would be the simplest of all transitional arrangements to accept it's going to take a while longer to get any sort of agreement whatsoever. The problem with that is not the law, though. It's the politics. I think the current government has made it clear that the UK is leaving the European Union at the end of March 2019. I don't think the British public would accept any delay to that date. Actually, I don't think the European Union would be keen either. So we are leaving in March 2019. The question is, at what pace, what sort of arrangements apply thereafter?
And what exactly is the government proposing?
Well, here I think it's helpful to separate out two things. One is the membership of the single market, and the other is the membership of the customs union. It's possible to be a member of one and not participate in the other. The government's position is that we are leaving the single market in March 2019, and that's essential if the UK is to regain control of its borders, to be able to restrict the free movement of people, to review EU regulation and so on. But if we are leaving the single market, it does mean that there is a risk that UK exports to the rest of the European Union will face tariffs of some type. However, the UK is proposing to remain in, or at least to replicate, the essentials of the customs union, at least on a temporary basis. So the aim here is going to be to minimise non-tariff barriers, borders checks and so on. And in many cases, these are actually more important to trade than tariffs. But that will mean a more lengthy delay before the UK can implement free trade deals with the rest of the world. You simply can't do that if you're in a customs union with the EU. So that policy has a cost too.
And how does that policy of replicating the customs union compare to what Labour has recently proposed? Of course, there has recently been a U-turn within the Labour Party. They've abandoned their position of leaving the single market and now seem to be proposing a far softer Brexit.
Well, yes, in a sense, what Labour is proposing to do is effectively delaying Brexit. So politically, we would leave in March 2019, but we would retain two of the most important economic components of the relationship, namely both the single market and the customs union. This might look attractive to some. It clearly would minimise disruption before a comprehensive free trade deal could be done. It would minimise disruption because in practice nothing much would change. But equally, it wouldn't allow us to begin to exploit any of the benefits of leaving the European Union. And I think also there's a big political risk here. The risk, of course, is that a temporary arrangement becomes permanent. We might end up with a so-called soft Brexit, where we stay in both the single market and the customs union, and that isn't really Brexit at all. Well, there's a worst case where, because nothing's really changed after March 2019, it's much easier for a future government to decide we're actually going to remain within the European Union altogether.
And those dangers are, of course, real, and I agree with you that that would be the Brexit that you've described would be a Brexit in name only. We've also discussed the lack of clarity for businesses and the need for reassurances quickly. And the progress from the negotiations so far, I mean, correct me if you disagree, but don't seem to be looking all that positive. Is there still not a case for potentially dragging out the process a little bit longer to allow for further negotiations and discussions?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, realistically, we're not going to get everything done in time for a nice clean piece of paper to be signed for March 2019. So we do need some sort of transitional arrangements. It's worth stressing that there are various other arrangements that we could adopt on a transitional basis. So, for example, we could leave the single market but negotiate a temporary, what's called a zero-for-zero deal on trade tariffs, which would be allowed under WTO rules, provided it were temporary and as part of a move towards a more permanent deal thereafter. There's a lot that we could secure in terms of equivalency on regulation. That's a particularly important issue for the city, for financial services and legal services industries and other professional services industries. So there are other things that we can agree, I think, in time to have something in place. Crucially, I think we can do much better than Labour's proposal of essentially throwing your hands up in the air and saying we'll stick with both the single market and the customs union. I think things do need to start changing from March 2019, and there are some things we can start changing straight away.
Can I ask you, going back to the equivalency on regulations, I remember hearing talk, especially during the actual the process of the Brexit vote, hearing quite a lot about, a passport for financial services between... which would be especially important for London, of course. Can you explain a little more about what that was and if that's still a possibility?
Well, in a nutshell, the passport for financial services is a piece of paper, or a principle at least, that allows any member of the European Union to trade freely with other members. So if, for example, you're a UK bank, you effectively have a passport that allows you to sell products in Germany, in France, across the whole of the European Union. When we leave the European Union, those passports will no longer apply. They simply won't exist. So the question is, what will replace them? One possibility is what's known as equivalence, where the European Union recognises that our regulations for controlling financial services are very similar to theirs. So we'll have what is effectively the same as a passport. But in one sense, of course, not quite as good, because the EU at some point in the future might decide actually our regulations aren't quite as good as theirs and withdraw that right. The question then becomes, would it be in their interest to do so if the European Union decides to restrict access of their own consumers, households, businesses, their own financial institutions to the resources the city can supply? Then that's clearly not in their interests. But also, if at some point in the future the European Union did decide to take a more difficult stance towards the city, what's that telling us about the relationship we want to have with the European Union? If they are going to continue to put politics above their own economic interests, is this really a club that we want to be a member of? So although some people say that equivalency isn't quite as good as passporting, I think in practice we can make it work just as well. And if it's the European Union that decides to be awkward, then maybe that's an argument for leaving rather than staying.
You say that it is in the economic interest. Of course, free trade benefits consumers most of all. But now the two most important countries left in the EU, France and Germany, both are lining up cities to potentially replace London as the centre of global commerce. It may be that there is, in fact, some incentive for them to hamper the progress of our financial institutions.
Well, I think there's no doubt that the City of London will lose some business to other financial centres across Europe. I think, frankly, that's inevitable. It's already starting to happen. We've seen that already with various banks announcing moves to Dublin, to Frankfurt, even to Paris. But I wouldn't overestimate the importance of that. I think that the City of London and UK financial centres in general still have huge competitive advantages over other centres in Europe. Because of our more favourable business environment, lower taxes and so on, which will exist long after we've left the European Union. And in the longer term, there may even be some advantages in being located outside the European Union rather than in. So, for example, if EU regulation of the financial services sector is tightened, if the so-called financial transactions tax is introduced, or there are additional restrictions on bankers' bonuses and so on, then being outside those rules by being based in the City of London or elsewhere within the UK might actually be a positive. So, yes, I've got no doubt there are some risks here to the city, but I think overall those risks are easy to overstate. Most financial institutions, most providers of professional services will do the bare minimum that they need to meet any EU regulations rather than relocate lock, stock and barrel from London.
So generally, coming back to the idea of transitional agreements, what do I mean, some of the options that you've described, the Norway option, remaining the single market, but leaving the customs union, and what does this mean in practice for the Brexit bill? I mean, realistically, how much would Britain have to continue paying to the EU in order to get a transitional deal that's worth its salt, especially given some of the huge sums of money that have been floating around from the negotiating team?
Well, here I think it's always worth starting from the fundamental principle that the UK doesn't have to pay a penny. It would be on very strong legal ground if it decided to walk away. However, as the government, in particular David Davis, has stressed, it's important to look not just at the letter of the law, but also the spirit of any future relationship. And if by paying a bit more to the European Union we can get something decent in return, then I think that is a price worth paying. And perhaps some sort of agreement over transitional arrangement would be one justification for paying a bigger bill. So, for example, if we are going to remain in some form of customs union, to have some sort of a loose relationship based around the existing single market, then perhaps we should make some contribution. It wouldn't, though, I suggest, be as much as our current annual contribution to the European Union, because, after all, that's for full membership. We'd only be talking about some sort of associate relationship. It might be that under the Labour plan, we would end up continuing with our current annual contributions because they're suggesting that nothing much changes. But if we have a scaled back relationship, then perhaps paying half the amount that we're currently paying for 2 to 3 years during a transitional period is a fair arrangement. That sort of number, though, would be far nearer something like £25 billion than the £50 billion that some people have suggested. And crucially also, it's money that we would be paying anyway if we remained a member. So it's not a cost of leaving. It's simply something that we're paying in order to smooth the departure.
It is a natural part of negotiating to kind of impose a very hardball figure and then ultimately come down to a lower figure. And I suppose that it's in the EU's interest to get some money from us rather than none at all as a significant contributor.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, the initial figures that are being suggested by the European Union, well, we have seen numbers as high as more than 100 billion euros, which at current exchange rates is more than 90 billion pounds. I don't think that was ever realistic, but as you say, in any negotiation, you aim high and then you compromise somewhere in the middle. The figures being suggested recently that the UK might be willing to agree, well, two of the most important words in the English language are up to. The figures I'd seen were up to 50 billion, which clearly includes numbers like 40, 30 and 20. I suspect we'll actually open at around about 20 and we'll probably settle at about 30 or 40. But the key thing is, in a sense, not so much the number itself, but what we're getting in return for it. If we were going to get nothing in return for the divorce bill, then I suggest that we should pay nothing for it.
And
legally we'll be in a strong position to do so.
And I think the suggestion we've had from the EU negotiators that we have to fork out a large sum before we can even begin to have the discussions is clearly ludicrous. How could you go to British taxpayers as a government and say, yes, we've spent X amount of your money, we've got precisely nothing from it so far, this is purely in order to get everyone around the table?
Well, you're right. This is one of the weaknesses of the European Union approach. They have a very rigid set of bargaining rules, so that there are certain things that need to be decided, or at least substantial progress made on them, before they can move on to other things. But these are things that are very hard to disentangle. One example is the divorce bill. It's very hard to agree what the divorce bill is going to be until you've decided what the future relationship is going to be. Similarly, issues like the borders for Northern Ireland, unless you have an agreement on the broader relationship between the UK and the rest of the European Union, it's very hard to decide how one specific part of the UK will relate to another small part of the European Union. So I think this is an area where the European Union's own bargaining criteria are making the negotiations more difficult than they need to be. It's clear that the UK is going to have to show some flexibility in many areas, but equally Europe will have to do so as well.
What did you make of the way in which the negotiations, not just how they're going so far, but also how they've been reported? Because I think that the general reporting style has been one of, I suppose, panic and alarm that, you know, we're not making a great deal of headway, when we do forget that we are actually only at the very beginning of a much longer process.
Well, two general points there. I mean, first of all, it's always the case that newspapers like bad news rather than good. So they'll always look for the examples of things that aren't going as well. And the second point is that the vast majority of at least the so-called mainstream media are probably anti-Brexit. The Remain newspapers are inevitably going to emphasise the disagreements rather than the agreements. But I think, frankly, we're pretty much where we'd expect to be at this stage in the talks. There have been a number of areas where progress has been made. For example, on issues such as citizens' rights to healthcare. Positive noises on the details of a Northern Ireland border settlement and so on. It is very hard to see how much could be agreed anyway until we know the outcome of the German elections in October. So I think we have made some progress, but it's a negotiation. The purpose of the negotiation is not to make the other side happy from day one, particularly when the parties concerned obviously have their own domestic political agendas as well. So I'm not overly concerned at this stage. That said, given that uncertainty about the outcome of these talks is starting to weigh on confidence, business confidence, consumer confidence, I think it is important we have something a bit more tangible to point to by Christmas. And the good news there is I think we will get that.
If you like what you've heard, head to our website, iea.org.uk, for more information, reports, blogs, and podcasts from our Brexit unit.